DJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we introduce the campaign helping to renew the NDP and put it in the hands of the grassroots on The Breach Show, and speak with NDP leadership candidates Labour leader Rob Ashton, activist Abby Lewis, and Member of Parliament Heather McPherson on three new episodes of Bubble Pop. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. In this excerpt from a new episode, former Member of Parliament for Hamilton Centre, Matt Green, sits down with host Desmond Cole in Toronto to discuss the campaign he's helping to guide to renew the NDP and put it in the hands of the grassroots. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. After taking some serious losses in last year's federal election, the new Democratic Party, the NDP, is trying to figure out what went wrong and how it can rebuild. Some former members of parliament who lost their seats last year are now leading a campaign of party renewal, an initiative to mobilize the party's grassroots, inspire activists, and make the party more democratic. So, what are the prospects for that renewal? And will the party's leadership listen to these calls? Joining me today to discuss all of this is Matthew Green, the former NDP Member of Parliament in Hamilton Centre, who was defeated in the 2025 election. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you so much, Desmond.
It's a pleasure. Matthew, you represented Hamilton Centre from 2019 to 2025. And so before we talk about this renewal, I just want to ask you, what has your life personally been like these last many months not being in the House of Commons anymore?
Well, I had a chance to regulate my nervous system a little bit. I'm out of fight or flight. I'm enjoying my family. I'm loving being back in community. You know, the job title might change, but the work stays the same. So we've just gone right back to what got us here in the first place, which is, you know, reaching out between neighbors, having critical discussions without the kind of false sense of urgency and importance that often surrounds the Ottawa bubble.
I'm glad to hear you're feeling a little more chill these days. That's very nice. Still working and still busy, obviously active within the NDP, a party that has undergone its own review of the last election campaign, as it does after every election. And that's separate from your now renewal initiative that you're doing. So I read a little bit about the NDP's review of last year's election. And in short, the party really seems to be saying that the setbacks of the 2025 election, where the party lost its official party status, were mainly outside of the NDP's control. You know, we have had this big conflict with the United States, obviously, with US President Donald Trump, tariffs, and it seems to be that the NDP says that that was the ballot question. People saw the Liberals as better positioned than the NDP to fight Trump. And so there wasn't really much that the NDP could do to kind of make its case better in the last election, to change its fortunes. I wonder, do you agree with that assessment?
Donald Trump's attack on our sovereignty, the threats to not just impose tariffs as he has, but also potentially annex Canada, were a black swan event that we could not have prepared for. But I would also argue that the gradual decline of our party has happened over the last 10 or 15 years. And I think much of what faces the general public in terms of political estrangements, not feeling attached or connected to decision-making, is also reflective in our party. And so by over-centralizing decision-making, by over-centralizing control, and reducing the democratic distribution across membership, I think people just did not feel the connection to the party. Obviously, our communications were not resonating. We started the campaign off with this idea that it was going to be Jagmeet and some sort of cage match against Pierre Poilievre, when ultimately what it came down to was a scenario where we really needed to communicate to Canadians that our Westminster parliamentary system works better with multiple parties. We've been reduced to a two-party system, effectively. Most Canadians think that they're voting for a prime minister when they're not. And I think we fail to, A, connect with our base, B, expand that, and also C, communicate to people what was required in this moment to ensure that working class voices were still reflected in Ottawa. And in that failure, we're now left with two conservative parties, albeit one more progressive than the other. These are two conservative parties who are, you know, fighting this faux culture war, but ultimately getting the kinds of economic policies that Harper could have only dreamed of.
Now, you mentioned that we don't directly elect the prime minister of the country, and that's true. However, leadership obviously plays a huge role in how campaigns play out and how media coverage plays out, how people understand the parties. And you mentioned Jagmeet Singh. He took a lot of criticism, obviously, for a lot of the election losses that just happened. Do you think it's fair to attribute, at least in part, the kind of poor campaign showing of the last election to Jagmeet Singh, the former leader?
I don't personify the loss in Jagmeet. I think the strategy to put all of our concentration on the leadership rather than communicate the strength of the core members of the caucus, rather than, again, demonstrate that we can continue to be the conscience of the country. I don't think it was believable. I mean, it's not that I don't think. Canadians didn't think or believe that he was going to be prime minister. And so having Mark Carney instead of Pierre Poilievre could have happened still with 40 or 50 new Democrats. And there would have been a working class voice within the House of Commons. But by reducing our campaign messaging, our culture, to this kind of personification of the party in this charismatic leader, was ultimately the wrong strategy to choose and hasn't been successful since Jack Layton. But even when Jack Layton was successful, I think a lot of new Democrats, particularly those that were around him at the time, forget that the Conservative Party was in a free fall. The Bloc Québécois was in the wilderness. So the preconditions for Jack's success were very different and in fact can never be replicated. We had union donations and book offs. There was all different types per vote subsidies, all different types of things that allowed us to be competitive then that we don't have now. And so, you know, I call it the James Carville bow tie New Democrat who believed that if we just had the right focus group, the right product as a leader, that we could somehow break through. And that's just not the case. And I think in a lot of ways, Jagmeet was our charismatic answer to Justin Trudeau. And we thought if we could just out Trudeau the Liberals, we might be able to win. But what we come to find is that over the course of those 6 or 7 years of his leadership, that in this moment, what Canadians needed was a steady hand, somebody who they believed could be credible with the economy, and ultimately deferred to the authority of a central banker. And so it's not even the case, Desmond, that Bay Street got their guy. In this case, Wall Street got their guy. And now we have a CEO running the country exactly like a CEO would.
By the way, I think that this is probably the first ever James Carville reference on The Breach Show. Very well done. You mentioned the centralization of power inside of the party, and I want to talk more about that. Where does power really lie in the NDP right now? Who gets to make the important decisions?
From my observation, there's a cadre of, you know, party stalwarts who consider themselves the adults in the room. Again, a lot of these people would have had the halo effect from being around the Jack Layton campaign some 20 years ago. These are people that have gone on to be talking heads for the party. They're pundits. They're connected to GR firms.
GR?
Government relations firms. So their work is now in brokering power rather than winning it. And as an example, you know, our former national director who became our principal secretary, to this day, I'm not sure what a principal secretary in that context does, but she's now working, you know, in a GR firm alongside the campaign chair of Mark Carney. And so at the end, like that Ottawa bubble, that kind of, you know, champagne circuit that's out there often lends itself to a level of assumed expertise on what average Canadians want. And ultimately, I think leads to what we've just experienced in the last three elections, a steady decline of the party by not taking bold positions and clearly differentiating ourselves from the Liberal Party.
And how does this play out, like, specifically? Because, you know, you were on the inside. You saw how decisions were being made, I gather. So let's take something like, you know, the supply and confidence agreement between the Liberals and the NDP, or the NDP's evolving stance on Palestine, or things like that. How does the party actually say, here's what our stance is going to be, here's what our policy positions are going to be, here's what we're going to go out and say to Canadians? How does that play out? Who's actually having those discussions? Who's saying, finally, yes, this is the direction we're going to go in?
I would say on the vast majority of, you know, the decisions that are made, there is, I would argue, more of a democratic process within our caucus than within other parties. That's relatively speaking. In other words, we defer to critics. Again, the internal workings of our party as the fourth party opposition meant, by definition, we didn't have the resources to have a central policy bureau, a research bureau that would hand us from a high the talking points and directions of any given issue. I would often see in committees, you know, Liberals and Conservatives get an email from somebody and their entire direction change kind of at the drop of a hat or the push of a button. We didn't have that. But on issues that were considered third rail, so you mentioned Palestine, pipelines, I would say in a lot of ways, Quebec sovereignty and this idea of, you know, what multiculturalism looks like in Quebec, these third rail issues were absolutely predetermined by the leadership. And when I say the leadership, I mean the chief of staff, sometimes maybe the national director, but often the national director is at the direction of the chief of staff. And so for those that are listening that don't know what the chief of staff is, that would be the senior most person on the caucus side. So the caucus representing all the elected MPs. In theory, there's a caucus side and a party side. And the party side should be democratically elected as federal councillors that would then determine a national director. But in practice and in reality, the national director has been appointed directly by the leader. And so, again, I would argue, and as would many scholars who follow the NDP, that Jack Layton's brush with success and almost becoming the first NDP prime minister adopted this culture where the leader ruled supreme in many ways. And the federal council took on a culture of being a bit of a rubber stamp. And in that, you know, you have unelected people who are not accountable necessarily to the membership or to their constituents, as we were as MPs, making critical decisions. I would be fair to them to say, and you reference Palestine, that in my fight to pull the party closer to a moral and just position on Palestine, there was lots of spirited debate, but they never told me I had to take down tweets. They never told me I had to retract statements. And I was making statements on the question long before October 7th. And, you know, we ultimately got to a place where, again, we moved an opposition day motion and spoke about the question of Palestine more in one day than any other party had in the history of the country. So again, the big issues were left to, quote unquote, the adults in the room. Who consulted with them, I don't know. I don't know who their focus groups were or their consultant references were. But what I do know is that sometimes it's the case in caucuses where the leader comes in with a decision that's already made. And caucus is simply something to allow people to sound their dissenting views. And then ultimately we walk out in unison on whatever the issue is. And by and large, we were a fairly cohesive caucus. But that doesn't mean we didn't have very spirited and sometimes tenuous debates inside caucus. I made the mistake coming from city council that caucus was like a democratic process and the majority would win. That is not the case in party politics nationally.
So you're giving us a very top-down, I would say, type of impression of decision-making. Is that fair to say?
Oh, it's absolutely top-down because, again, the whole idea of the party, one of the first questions I had when people kept referring to the party, they would refer to it almost in third person. I thought I was the party. I thought rank and file membership was the party. I come to find out the party was the central leadership, or at least that's, you know, the interpretation that I took from the way in which decisions were made and the way in which the party was referenced, that the leader was the personification of the party. Therefore, the leader's traits, vibes, you know, were marketed as a replacement for the values of the party. So in any given day, a statement of the leader is the de facto position of the party. When, you know, that comes with a complete lack of consultation with the grassroots and the membership, and oftentimes, you know, everyday Canadians.
That was a highlight from a new episode of The Breed Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. And find more at Journalism for Transformation at breachmedia.ca. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station from Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore in Montreal, breaks down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On these highlights from three new episodes, Rachel welcomes three NDP leadership race contenders. First, BC-based Labour leader Rob Ashton explains why his campaign's laser-focused on affordability and inequality. Then Vancouver activist Avi Lewis unpacks his progressive policy proposal Big Swings. And finally, Edmonton Strathcona Member of Parliament Heather McPherson gives her take on the future of the party and her vision to lead it. Here's Rachel.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop. It's the show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And we are back from our little mid-season break and we are still doing it live, baby. So as you know, if you want to support the show, you can subscribe on Patreon, Substack, YouTube, basically anywhere that you like to listen. While you're watching live, you can also ask a question using the super chat function on YouTube. I try to take some questions that aren't super chats if I can. So we'll be doing that in the last 10 minutes of the show while we're live. So hope to see some of those from you guys. But today, we are jumping right back in with the NDP leadership race. Maybe CBC was questioning if it is indeed a nail biter, if anyone is watching. But I think that we are paying attention and we are interested, right, folks? So we are inching closer to the March convention when New Democrats will choose Jagmeet Singh's successor. But an even more important deadline is coming up in a week. That is the membership sign-up deadline on January 28th. I'm sure you guys are going to hear a lot about that from the candidates in the next week. Anyone who wants to cast a ballot for the next NDP leader will have to have an active membership with the NDP by that date. So that means candidates are going to be racing to get their supporters signed up before it's too late. Dun, dun. Done. One of those people vying for the precious membership votes in the hopes of helming the NDP is Avi Lewis. He is a veteran journalist. I mean, this guy talked politics for Much Music back in the day. And he's also a documentary filmmaker. He's also an associate professor at the University of British Columbia and has a history of deep involvement with efforts for bold climate-focused societal change from the Leap Manifesto to the Green New Deal. Now he's seen as one of the front runners in the NDP leadership race. He's got a message of tough talk for billionaires and unabashedly progressive ideas for the cost of living. But he's never been elected as an MP, and he's already facing some barbs from another candidate, Rob Ashton, who has accused Avi Lewis of dividing the party. Was that the first time anyone in an NDP leadership race has done anything but violently agree? Anyway, all of this has me feeling very excited to hear from today's guest, Avi Lewis. Welcome to Bubble Pop.
What a great intro. Violent agreement. Stay tuned for more violent agreement in the NDP leadership race.
Literally, Nathan Cullen coined that, and he is not wrong. It really is I think he said it in 2011, and it continues to be true. So, Avi, I want to hear your elevator pitch, right? You got all of Canada in an elevator with you. It's a very large elevator, apparently.
And it's crowded. I'm a little claustrophobic, but
extremely crowded. Yeah. What I want to hear from you, speaking of violent agreement, is what actually sets you apart from the other folks running for NDP leadership?
I think when we launched our campaign in September, we just went out with bold solutions. And we've been leading with ideas, with proposals for actually addressing the crises that we face, the everyday emergency of just trying to get by in a rigged economy, the cost of everything, the threats from the United States, the desperate need for Canada to have an independent foreign policy, to have a real two-way arms embargo on Israel, which is committing genocide in Gaza, and actually address the things that are really on people's minds with very straight talk and very clear solutions. And, we came out with the proposal for a public option for groceries because Galen Weston is worth $18 billion. And there's a straight line from the profit-taking and the collusion among the grocery billionaires and the price of the ridiculous, absurd price of things in your basket at the grocery checkout. And, 3 weeks later, after we launched, the Globe and Mail devoted its Thanksgiving Monday lead editorial to explaining to Canadians in its tone of 30,000 foot reasonable condescension this was an absurd idea and couldn't possibly work, and there are much better ways to have competition that were all kind of tweaks to the current system. So these ideas have actually provoked debate. They've stirred a lot of excitement at the base. And I think from a Canadian Green New Deal to public options and housing and cell phones and groceries, we'll get into more of the details, I'm sure, in our conversation. It's really been the ideas. And maybe one other thing that distinguishes our campaign a little bit from the others is that I find myself saying regularly, it's actually not about me. Yes, leaders, we need leaders, and leaders have to lead. But if we're talking about the party of workers, the party of the 99%, and we're doing decentralized, distributed organizing, where we really reawaken and re-empower our base, it's really about what we can do together. None of these things, from universal healthcare to even to the 8-hour day, none of them were won by the leaders. They were won by movements of people acting collectively and surging in popular power, and that's what we need to win. And so de-emphasizing the cult of leadership, I think, is something that is a little different on our campaign.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's sort of against the grain in modern politics. If you think about it, so much of the campaigns that we have seen have really focused on the leaders in a lot of Western democracies and failing democracies as well. Before I get on a total tangent with that, I did want to hone in a bit more on your ideas. And I'm glad you brought up the Globe and Mail example, because I want to touch on that sort of response too, because obviously you've taken some big swings here. I think that you actually, that's a term you use for it, that we're taking big swings.
Hell yeah.
Which is very cool to see. As you said, you focus a lot on offering public options for groceries, telecom services, home building, pharmaceuticals, and more. You also want to expand healthcare and homelessness, impose a national rent cap, push for free and reliable transit. And that's not even close to everything that's on your campaign site. It's a lot of exciting sounding stuff, which means I can already hear the National Post op-eds just churning out. And I can also, frankly, hear some pushback from the Power and Politics panels, particularly Chantal Hébert always brings up the jurisdictions in our federation, right? So how do you respond to those criticisms that some of these big swings are going to kind of trample on the toes of provinces, of municipalities that sometimes take issue with being trampled on? So how do you get this done in light of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a legit concern. And obviously, navigating the jurisdictions of our constitutional arrangement is a fundamental task for any you know, national public policy. And those things are real. But also, there's a tendency of politicians to say the word jurisdiction when they don't want to do something. And it's something that politicians often hide behind. Look, how do we have universal single-payer healthcare in Canada when healthcare is a provincial responsibility and Ontario and Alberta under Doug Ford and Danielle Smith are privatizing healthcare and do not want universal single-payer healthcare? We have it because the federal government has the power of the purse and it has the ability to fund as a national government these big, big structures in our public landscape. And so that's how the federal government gets all kinds of things done. Yes, of course, it's a negotiation, but it is possible for the federal government to lead. And the only expansion that we've seen, for instance, to our healthcare system in a generation, the introduction of pharmacare within our single-payer healthcare system for birth control drugs and diabetes drugs and medical devices, was won by the last NDP caucus under Jagmeet and the crew, and extracted from the Liberal majority and has been implemented in a number of provinces. And had they moved faster, could have been implemented in every province across the country by negotiating with the provinces and offering an expansion of a dignified life for all. And, you know, that's a political question of how the federal government can build support for these policies and make them incredibly popular when they explain them and communicate them clearly and passionately. It's also a matter of the technology and the technocracy of like getting it done and, you know, all the great policy weeds that the nerds love to delve into. But it's possible. And in a time when people are working harder and harder and harder and wages never keep up and prices never stop escalating, and it just doesn't seem to matter how hard you throw down, our deal as Canadians is getting shittier and shittier. And everybody knows it. And so we need big solutions at this point because life has gotten so bad despite how hard everyone's working. So I think there's like a moral imperative too for someone in the political space to lead with solutions that are as big as the crises we face. And a leadership campaign is a great idea to throw those things out there.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that one thing I'm always struck by is how whenever you speak about these big ideas, whether it be you or anyone really, like if I'm just sitting with friends having dinner or something and we start talking about these things, the immediate response, and I don't know if this is a Canadian thing or a human thing, is this degree of cynicism. And getting involved in our interview.
Do you want me to bring my dog and they can negotiate?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, definitely. This is my jurisdiction.
I think they're both girls too. So, you know, a little, we got the girl power in the background
right
here. So I know I creeped you hardcore. Like I was researching last night.
You know the, wow.
Yeah, I know the gender of your dog. That's how deep we're going. I got these old Much Music pictures that I found on YouTube videos.
Outside the Rex Hotel on Queen Street.
Are you trying
to be Nardwar? Because that Order of Canada recipient, Nardwar the Human Serviette, is still working, you know.
I was hoping I would get a Nardwar comparison with this one. That's what I was aiming for. So we can wrap it up now.
Bye.
Yeah, but on this very happy note, let's keep talking about cynicism because that is the thing that I feel like these ideas always come up against. And the cynic in me is thinking, well, maybe that's because these ideas once implemented are so incredibly popular that you can't beat them once they're in place. So you got to destroy the idea initially.
Wow, but, that you is know, so true. Like healthcare is the perfect example of that.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're having to, you know, systematically defund it and, you know, break it so that they can privatize it. But
that's it.
But I did want to ask you, I mean, it sometimes does feel like in the Canadian information ecosystem, there's almost a race to see who can express the most cynicism first, whether it be in columns or in the punditry on the media. You know, assuming you agree with that premise that I just laid out, I'm curious how we break that cycle so that we can genuinely start having these conversations instead of just debating whether they're even possible as ideas.
I mean, some of this is structural in our democracy and some of this is cultural in our 21st century, you know, weird world that we live in. But if you like, you know, we live in a country where a political party can get 36% of the popular vote and have a majority government with almost complete power with few checks and balances. And so obviously people that first past the post system, I think has really it's really polluted our own feeling about our franchise, about our democratic participation in elections. People in Canada, we have a phrase in Canada, I held my nose and voted for X or Y candidate, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is toxic. It means that people feel shameful about their vote. They feel ambivalent about it. They feel that it's pointless because they can't vote their conscience